We think once again about motherhood, and more specifically, structure and quiet time. Hey, welcome. We have another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. She called us to live to a higher standard and not be satisfied with just a little empty religion as some kind of shallow substitute for what we could have. Our series will continue in the coming weeks with family, friends, and others, all influenced by Elizabeth's life and message. Hey, thank you for coming along. Well, we're up to part 5 and 6 of a 17-part look at the call to motherhood. Also, as we continue thinking about family, today Valerie Shepherd will join her mother Elizabeth and talk about quiet time and discipline. And we'll also be hearing from more family members. We have Jim and Andrea Hawthorne, nephew and niece of Elizabeth and Jim. They'll be talking about the issue of forgiveness and examples of forgiveness in the family. What set Jim Elliot apart, even as a college student? That coming later. First, though, it's part 5 of The Call to Motherhood. Elizabeth and Valerie, let's get things started as we think about quiet time and discipline.
One of the things that I find very irritating when I'm on making a phone call to someone who has a small child is that the child is constantly interrupting. You must have that problem too, Val. What do you do about it?
Yes, I do have that problem, and I haven't quite found the solution. I think the solution is probably spanking. Even my 9-year-old was interrupting me on the phone just yesterday because she thought it was something I could point to without having to say anything to her. She was looking for something on my desk, and I was by my desk, and so she kept asking, "Where's the calculator?" And I was trying to talk to this person and trying to figure out where the calculator was, but I do not want my children interrupting me, so I know that if I... What do you suggest I do with Elizabeth?
Well, it is a little late with Elizabeth, isn't it? She's 9 years old. It would seem to me that, as in all other matters of discipline, you need to start as early as possible to let the child know that you really mean what you say. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend that you stop the telephone conversation, hang up, in order to spank the child. You would say to the person on the phone, "Excuse me one moment," and turn to the child and say, "You must not interrupt me when I'm on the phone." Then you go back to the conversation. Presumably the child's not going to interrupt you again before the end of it. Your children anyway, because they are relatively disciplined. But then wouldn't it be best when you have hung up the phone then to take the child on your lap and say, "I've told you you're not to disobey me. You are not to interrupt when I'm on the phone. You interrupted me. Now I must spank you." Mm-hmm. Would that be a way to deal with it sooner?
Yes.
And with Elizabeth, now at the age of 9, I'm not suggesting you spank her, but there would be some kind of punishment, you know, no dessert tonight or
right.
Something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see it as a necessity that the father and mother be united? Do you present a united front in disciplining your children?
Yes, I absolutely believe in that. My husband and I have to agree that the children have to be disciplined in a certain way, and that I would submit to him if he says they should not do something that I think would be all right, but I would say, "Let's find out what Daddy says." The question is often coming up, "Mama, can I go do this?" And I might say yes, usually going to visit a friend or something, but then I might find out from my husband that he had planned something for that night he hadn't told me yet, and he wanted to do something with the whole family. So I always say to them, "We'll check with Daddy first, and if it's all right with Daddy, then it's all right with me, and you can do it."
Well, Val, you sound as though you're a very strong person, and you've got it all together, and you're very organized. Of course, I know you better than that, but the way you're coming across perhaps to the listeners, they would say, "Oh, well, forget it, I'll never be able to get it together the way she has." What's your response to that?
I am not all together. I'm not as organized as I want to be. I'm not as disciplined as I want to be. My constant cry to the Lord is, "Lord, help me to do what you want me to do. Help me to teach the children and train them as you want me to. And please give me the strength and the will to follow through when I expect them to obey on something. Help me to follow through and correct them, punish them in the way that they should be punished. And I feel very, very weak, very inconsistent with the things that I know I ought to do, I don't always do. So I'm not as disciplined as people think I am. I have to ask the Lord constantly for help.
And it seems to me that that is the secret of your life, Val. I know that you are extremely vulnerable. I don't want to tell the people how many times I've talked to you on the phone and you've broken down, and I could hear the tears on the other end of the phone because some little thing, what I would think of as a little thing, had taken place. And you really feel very inadequate, and you ask me for advice. But I know that the primary source of your power is prayer and that quiet time that you have with the Lord. And that brings up another question that so many young mothers feel is a real impossibility, to have any quiet time. Now, do you have a fixed time of day which is absolutely sacrosanct, that never can be varied?
No, I do not have a fixed time of the day. When I have my quiet time, it would be early in the morning before anybody is up. It seems that the Lord has recently given me maybe two mornings out of a week where I get up extra early and have an extra long time with Him to read and pray and think and maybe think through the schedule. And then there are many mornings when I don't get, even though I get up early, because of the baby or the two-year-old, because of their interruption, I don't get the quiet time in. And I have to, on those days, I have to pray, Lord, help me to be devoted to You throughout this day, even though I didn't get my devotions in, but to be devoted in all that I do, and to always be looking up to Jesus to ask for His help and trust Him to be with me through the day.
And in the first chapter of James, it says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally. And I'm sure that that is certainly the source of your strength, what strength there is there, which certainly comes from the Lord. The scripture says that He knoweth our frame. He remembereth that we are dust. And that's a comfort to me so often, because it's my aim, too, to live an organized life and to have a set time for quiet and to be alone with the Lord. But God knows all about the interruptions. He knows about the things which have kept you up at night. If you have a sick child and you're up half the night, obviously you can't get up at the same time that you would normally get up and still have the strength to get through the day. So let's never forget that God is not a legalist.
Right.
And He is very much aware of the limits of our strength. So I would say to any women out there, young mothers who perhaps have not even tried to have a quiet time because they just feel that it's an impossibility, even 5 minutes mm-hmm. is a source of strength, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it possible to take a nap in the afternoon, Val, when you have six children?
Yes, I do. I often take a nap. The children almost always have a quiet time after lunch where they are to read books if they don't sleep themselves, so that they read, and that's my time to get whatever done I need to get done then, or take anywhere from a 10 to 20 minute nap. And I guess I got into the pattern of doing that with one of the babies falling asleep for just a few minutes, and that gave me refreshment for the rest of the day.
Now, do you mean to say that in a family of six children that you can get them to be quiet for how long?
The two-year-old takes a nap usually. The rest of them can be quiet, or they can be playing while I'm in my room with the door closed. There's not too much noise.
But there was a time when you had what you called a quiet hour, wasn't there, when each mm-hmm. child had to be alone in the room?
Yeah, it
and
doesn't
learn to occupy
it doesn't
himself.
Work in this house because they can't have a room by themselves. But yeah, I do make them read. At that time, they have to be reading books and not playing. Of course, the four-year-old doesn't read yet, but often I make him look at books, and so he's quiet for that hour.
One thing that's a revelation to me as the mother of one child, I suppose I imagine that if I'd had five children, they would all be carbon copies of you, Valerie, which is obviously ridiculous. I look at your six children, and I see tremendous differences in personality and temperament and abilities. And I've thought of how important it must be for the mother of more than one child to study and learn that child and recognize the particular gifts that God has given to that child, you have to really have a spirit of discernment and understanding mm-hmm. in order to see the needs of that child, mm-hmm. don't you?
Yes, and that's where I pray for wisdom all the time, for especially for the girls. I feel that Walter is very much like me. I can understand him pretty well. The two girls are so different from each other and seem to be so different from me.
The two older girls.
Yeah, I'm always asking the Lord for wisdom as to how to give them the right attention, what it is that they need. So I just trust God is giving me the discernment that I need. Sometimes I don't feel that I have it, but...
Would you say that some are tender-hearted and easily taught, more submissive than others? Have you
yes.
found that true?
Yes, definitely.
So one punishment might work for one child that wouldn't work for another one. Would that be the case? You started out with generally the same method of punishment
yeah,
when they were
spankings
small, didn't
all,
you?
All the time.
But
now
as
that
they get older,
they're
do
getting
to...
older. Yeah, I would say I definitely have to use two different kinds of punishment for the two girls.
Part 5 of The Call to Motherhood, Quiet Time, and Discipline. Let's hear from Jim and Andrea Hawthorne, niece and nephew of Elizabeth, as they talk about forgiveness and about examples of that in the family.
Yeah, one of the beautiful, poignant pictures we have in our memory from that trip to Ecuador was Jim Elliott's brother, Bert Elliott. Bert and Colleen served in Peru their whole lives, left on a ship right after they got married to go to sail to Peru and never came home from there. They met us in Ecuador. An image I have in my mind, and we actually have a photo of it, is of Bert Elliott, who was a very tall, large man, very gentle, very soft-spoken, very humble, very kind. And Dewey, who was one of the killers, who was just this short, small, tiny man, the big smile. And the picture we have in our mind is of Uncle Bert putting his hands on Dewey's shoulders, and Dewey reaching up and putting his hands on Uncle Bert's shoulders and them talking. I mean, they couldn't technically talk, but their smiles and their embrace and the way they interacted with each other was a really beautiful picture of forgiveness. And then Uncle Bert baptized several Guarani people in the Cururai River there where the men had died. So we saw some real beautiful images of forgiveness and the continuing of the gospel impact in that community.
I don't believe it was the first time that scene had taken place through the decades, but it was truly a stunning image, picture, experience of redemptive work that we could more than visualize, but knowing that the blood of those five men had been swept down the waters of the Cururai there, and then to see, again, that large circle of visitors and the Guarani people all gathered as Bert preached the gospel and was interpreted, and then we took communion together and the baptism.
Jim and Andrea Hawthorne. Later on, Elizabeth will talk about what set Jim apart, and it was a variety of things while he was in college. Hear about that later, but right now, the call to motherhood. What is the structure of a Christian home?
I know that I may give the impression sometimes of really dishing out a whole lot of advice and being very rigid and saying, this is the way you got to do it. This is the way we did it. This is the way my parents did it. This is the way I did it. And this is the right way. And you jolly well better shape up or ship out. Well, you know, I really don't want to come across that way. And I know that there are many different ways of doing things. But there are some principles, and there are some things which I felt helped to shape my own life, which I would hope would be of help to other people. So I hope that as I talk today about the structure of a Christian home, you will understand that I don't mean to be pontificating. I don't mean to be saying, look, you've got to do it this way. But for some who really are looking for direction and help, I hope that as an older woman, I can offer you some. I take very seriously my responsibility from Titus, the second chapter, where it says that the older women are to teach the younger. Well, you're listening to an older woman today, one who has 6 grandchildren, and this older woman would like to help some of you younger women who really do want some help. So let me say, first of all, that a Christian home should be based on love and trust and obedience. First of all, the love of the parents. As George MacDonald said, the very best thing that a father can do for his children is to love their mother. And the very best thing that a mother can do for her children is to love their father. The love between the husband and wife should be evident to the children. And it was in the home in which I grew up, and I'm so grateful for that. Then there has to be trust. There has to be the assurance that what people say, people mean. There has to be not just a high respect for the truth, but a strict respect for the truth. Lying has got to be punished, and I had my mouth washed out with soap at least once in my life because I lied. And there must be obedience. Love, trust, and obedience must be things which the children are taught very early, not in words so much as in action and in example. The children must learn that the parents love them, and there are 1,000 ways of showing that, of course. The fact that you care for them, the fact that you hug them, that you give them treats, that you do things for them, and you tell them that you love them, should be their earliest lessons in what love is all about. They must be able to trust your word. Don't make empty promises. Don't make empty threats. Perhaps this is one of the commonest mistakes that young parents make. If you do that, you're going to get a spanking. And the little child goes ahead and does it, but a spanking seems a little bit too severe, or it isn't very convenient, or the mother is tired, and somehow or other the child doesn't get the spanking, and he's not being taught that he has to trust the word. And obedience must be based on the authority of the parents, not on reasoning, but on authority. I had a young woman and a little 14-month-old baby in my home just recently. The baby touched something on the coffee table, and the mother said, "Don't touch, Susie." And Susie touched again. And mother said, "Don't touch, Susie." And she touched again. And so the mother went over and took the child's hand away and said, "Now don't touch that. That belongs to Mrs. Grin. That's very fragile. You might break that. And this is a glass coffee table. Don't touch that, honey. Thank you." And Susie touched it again. And the mother said, "Don't touch, honey. Thank you." And she kept saying, "Thank you," and "Don't touch." And she didn't get obedience. And to me, that's really a tragedy when that 14-month-old is being allowed to get away with that instead of having her little pink hand spanked. Remember that you are God to that child at the beginning. Does that sound like a startling statement? The mother and the father are really God in the sense that it is they whom the child must learn to love and trust and obey to begin with. They represent God to that child. They represent God's love, they represent his trustworthiness, and they represent the necessity to obey. The child must learn that you love him, that he can trust you, and he must obey you. And if he learns that from you, then I can testify from my own experience that it's really much easier to learn to love God, to trust him, and to obey him. Now that's a big order. You must start with yourself. First of all, you must love God and trust him and obey him. Do you love him? Jesus said, "If you love me, do what I say." Is there a determination in your heart to learn to love him and trust him and obey him? If you have to say no to that question, then that's the place where you need to start. Then you must learn to discipline yourself. It's no good trying to discipline children if you really have never made a very serious effort to discipline yourself. Remember that what you show them by example is far more powerful than anything that you can ever say. How can you tell your child to clean up his room and pick up his toys if you haven't cleaned up your room and picked up your toys? If your house is littered and messy? One young woman was telling me about her difficulties in getting underway in the morning, and she just felt as if everything was sort of chaos until about 11 o'clock. And she said, then at 11 o'clock, I get dressed, and I make my bed, and I put my makeup on. And she said, then I sort of feel as if I can start getting organized. Well, my suggestion to that young woman was, why don't you get yourself up at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock and get dressed and put on your makeup and maybe even make your bed before breakfast? And she looked at me as if, wow, you know, I never thought of that. I said, well, you know, you'll really be doing your husband a big favor if you come to breakfast dressed instead of looking like a wild witch. You'll be doing your children a great favor by setting an example of discipline. And it's just a whole lot nicer for everybody to see the mother with her clothes on and her makeup on, looking as though she's in her right mind at the breakfast table. Another matter of discipline is punctuality. When you tell people that supper will be at 6 o'clock, do you really mean 6:30, 6:45, 7:15? I'm not suggesting that supper has to be on the dot of 6 o'clock every night, even though it pretty much was in the house that I came from. But I am saying that you must teach your children the importance of time. Neatness. Do they know how to put things away? Do your children get out one game after another without putting the first one away? That's one of the things that I'm always trying to persuade my grandchildren to do. Before you start on another game or another set of toys, put away the first one. Make sure that there's a place for them to put it in. Then the matter of order, the structure of a Christian home, must begin with God's order, that the husband is the head. The wife respects her husband. She teaches the children to respect him by her example. The submission of the wife to the husband must come before the submission of children to their parents. If they don't see any submission there, they won't learn it. Love, trust, and obedience to God will be manifested in the order which the mother and father establish. And a husband, although he may not feel like being the head of the house and perhaps doesn't think he is very good at it, must be obedient to God as the head. God has assigned him to that headship. The wife is obedient to God in submitting to God's assignment of her husband's headship. And both of them, as faithful parents, are being obedient to God in bringing up the children. You don't just let your children grow up like Topsy. The Scripture commands fathers to bring up their children, to teach them in the admonition of the Lord. And as the father and the mother set the example of a structured Christian home, the children themselves will know where the lines are drawn. There will be much greater security. I guarantee that there will be more happiness and more peace in that kind of a home. It will be a home where what I like to call the mystery of charity is enacted. Love in action. The rule of that home is my life for yours. This really is the meaning of love, isn't it? The love which was enacted on Calvary. Jesus was saying, my life for yours, setting an example of suffering, sacrifice, and surrender. If Jesus, our Lord, set that kind of an example for us, you and I, by submitting in obedience to him, can set the same kind of example for our children. There will be joy, there will be fulfillment, and that Christian home will be a peaceful place of refuge and refreshment. Are you willing to ask God to help you to create that kind of a home?
Part 6 of The Call to Motherhood, The Structure of a Christian Home. Well, we've been thinking about family today, motherhood, and more. Let's hear about Jim Elliot now. What was it that made him different, even as a college student?
He was, for one thing, mysterious to us girls because being so handsome and so popular and never dating anybody, we were mystified. We found out, of course, that he had a very high and serious purpose, and he thought that women might be a distraction to that, so he wanted to keep his mind on his studies as long as he was a student. He was an athlete, a champion wrestler, a campus clown, a leader in the class, a president of the Foreign Missions Fellowship. We had an honors convocation every semester when the names of all the honors students were read out, and Jim's name was always read out in the honors convocations.
Wow.
And he graduated with highest honor in classical Greek. So it was an unusual combination, an athlete and a clown and a spiritual leader and also a scholar. All of those things attracted me. But I think most importantly, I was attracted by his personal discipline and his spiritual frame of mind.
Well, our time together is coming to an end, but thanks for letting us come into your home, your office, maybe along with you on that drive, wherever we found you today. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out elizabethelliot.org. More Gateway to Joy programs, videos, and other resources. elizabethelliot.org. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us. From Audible comes this review. Rebecca writes, "These episodes are treasured. Over the years of getting to know Elizabeth Elliot through her speaking and writing, I feel like I've come to know her and cherish her as a dear friend." Patty writes, "Elizabeth Elliot was an outstanding teacher. She is biblical, clear, and humble. She's my all-time favorite teacher. These recordings are a treasure." Well, thank you, Patty and Rebecca. And thank you, friend, for joining us today. Well, until next time, may God remind you each and every day. You're loved with an everlasting love. And underneath are those everlasting arms.